Well, Aristotle thinks of tragic poetry, I say, as somehow recognizing this very feature of action itself, the fact that no mode of virtue and of deliberation can guarantee the efficacy of human action and moral agency in bringing about the well-being or happiness that they aim for. Tragedy, on Aristotle's view, is a human institution that is designed to help us accept this fact. We may think of this acceptance as ultimately restorative of our trust in the world. Aristotle does. But it's not founded for him on, so to speak, a palliation of the tragic truth about the efficacy of human agency in the world. It isn't as though Aristotle is saying, don't worry, everything's going to be all right, blah, blah, blah. He is recognizing the fact that indeed there is a fundamental tragic rift in the world. It is the fact that we are not gods and cannot guarantee that our actions, however well they are worked out, will, as a matter of fact, bring about our well-being or the well-being of those whose well-being we are trying to bring about through our action. And thus it is that Aristotle thinks, in ways that he then spells out in his notion of catharsis or coming to terms or the purgation of the fear and pity that is occasioned by this thing, that tragic poetry might be seen to be an institution worked out in the actual city itself and as part of the cultural or civilized institutions of human civilized life that might help us to come to terms with that. The Poetics, therefore, can be seen in this sense as a sequel, as it were, to the Ethics and the Politics in a deeper sense than that in which it continues, as I was suggesting earlier, philosophical interests that are central to the theory of human action in these works. More importantly, the Poetics continues the vision that's developed in those companion volumes that we talked about in the last lecture and at the beginning of this lecture, the companion volumes of the Ethics and the Politics, continues the vision of the polis, or more generally of organized social, communal, or as I put it last time, civilized activity, as the source of our capacity to live satisfying and fulfilling human lives. The Nicomachean Ethics and the Politics alike see civic life as the matrix, I suggested, in which virtue may be formed and nurtured as means to the achievement of human happiness and well-being. But in tragedy, our gaze is directed upon the vulnerability of that well-being. We're invited to acknowledge the fears that are occasioned by that vulnerability. These are the realistic fears, the well-founded fears, the true and correct fears, that politically nurtured virtue, that good choice, good intentions, well action, good action, may not always be sufficient for the well-being at which it aims, and that our happiness, therefore, is subject to the stern and the seemingly irrational control of a destiny which may at any moment simply sunder the tenuous connection between virtue and well-being. A destiny which is the result neither of some inner flaw of character on our part, nor of some external daimon, some external demon of ill fortune, but of the very actions that we have thoughtfully and courageously and adequately and carefully chosen. That's what's so scary about it. And the Poetics offers us the hope that we may be able, by acknowledging these fears, to cleanse our affective lives of, so to speak, of their pollution, and that's the catharsis, to be restored to the fellowship of parlous, fearful human agency. That cleansing, the Poetic suggests, is only going to be accomplished through the agencies of institutions which are themselves artifacts of human, civilized, or cultured life. Institutions and artifacts rooted in our capacity for imaginative imitation, that is, our capacity for poetry. And so finally, at the end of the Poetics, Aristotle reveals, as Plato revealed before him, that poetry and its force may be one of the significant and most significant cultural institutions and powers that as human beings we possess. Well, in the final concluding lecture, I'm going to ask you to stand back and reflect on what we've had to say in these lectures about Greek philosophy. about Plato and Aristotle. I will briefly revisit some of the central points in their philosophical thought and ask what the salient features are of those points. And then I'll ask us to consider some comparative aspects with respect to Plato and Aristotle, that is, to think about how we ought, as they say in college examinations, to compare and contrast Plato and Aristotle. What might be the features in which what we've seen exhibits a common concern, and what are the interesting features in which we might see them as different from one another? Finally, I'll ask us to think about what we, as thinking, political, moral, understanding agents in the 21st century, can learn from these two giants of ancient philosophical thought.
This ends Lecture 13.